Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, Instagram has introduced teen accounts. We'll hear from Meta as to how they'll work and what the platform will do to catch those who try to trick the system. As tech companies call staff back to the office, we'll look at how company culture has shifted and ask if it's for the better. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. At the end of last week's show, I very confidently and very happily said I was going to bring you to San Francisco this week for Dreamforce, which is Salesforce's annual conference, but that didn't happen. I had a lovely lower respiratory tract infection instead. So rather than take you to a tech conference, later in the show, I'm going to tell you all the TV I watched and all the books that I read, because that is literally all I did this week. The glam life continues. But right now, we're going to talk about Instagram. The company, which is owned by Meta, announced this week it is launching teen accounts. As we've spoken about many times on this program, online safety is a huge issue. Many experts have called for platforms to do more, and this seems to be a significant step in the right direction. This was announced on Monday of this week, and I caught up with Tara Hopkins, who is the Global Director for Public Policy at Instagram, to learn a little bit more about it.
Absolutely. So today we're introducing Instagram Teen Accounts. It's a new experience for teens on Instagram that is guided by their parents. So we're reimagining our apps for teens, giving them more protections, and these protections are built in and turned on automatically. We want parents to feel confident that their teen can use social media to communicate with their friends and to explore their interests and to do that in a safe and protective way. So we've continued to focus and invest in this entire area on teen well-being and teen safety for well over a decade. But we're taking it now a step further, developing teen accounts, which we've worked with external experts and we've really listened to parents through research and through focus groups. And two key insights from our research and our consultations have really been built into Instagram teen accounts. The first is the need of younger teens on Instagram to have a different experience to those who are older teens. And no two teens we know are alike, and any parent will know that. The built-in protections for teen accounts are for all teens under the age of 18. But for younger teens, so those under the age of 16, the teen account experience has been tailored even more for them. So while older teens will have a little bit more autonomy, recognizing their maturity levels, those who are under the age of 16 will not be able to change any of the settings, the defaulted settings that we have for them on teen accounts, without getting their parents involved. The second insight is that parents play a really critical role in supporting their teens online. And when we talk to parents, they're especially concerned about three things: content that their teen is seeing, any unwanted contact, including things like bullying and harassment, and the time they're spending on social media. So what we've done is we've taken all of those insights and we've built them into the teen account experience on Instagram. It's a really big investment. It's a big step forward. And we think it's market leading work. We know that there is no silver bullet here. We need to continue to work with parents, teens, industry and government. But this really is a fundamental change for teens on Instagram. And we're really excited about it. It will be rolling out in the UK, the US, Canada and Australia from September the 17th. And so in Ireland and the rest of the EU, teens will start to be moved into teen accounts before the end of this year. I can go into a bit more detail as to exactly how it's going to look and feel for both the teen and the parents, if that helps you.
Yeah, absolutely. But before you do, I just wonder, could you tell us a little bit more about the process? Because this seems to be a bit more of a solutions-based approach, rather than removing younger people entirely from the platform, which would cause them to lose out on the benefits of social media, which do exist, you're essentially putting safeguards around them.
Exactly. We know that teens get a huge amount of value, as do, many people who are using Instagram and social media to connect with their friends and to be able to explore the things and the interests that they have. So we think it's important that teenagers, particularly, are able to do that in the most protective way possible. And we want to be able to give parents that peace of mind that the young person who is using Instagram is having that safe and more protective experience. And as I said, parents told us that the three things they're concerned about are who their teen is talking to online, the content that they're seeing, and whether their time is being really well spent. And so Teen Accounts, launching today, is addressing all of those three things. So we're automatically placing teens, any teen under the age of 18, into the teen account experience. And then if a teen is under the age of 16, they will need their parents' permission through the Instagram supervision tool to change any of those settings. And while Teen Accounts puts new protections in place automatically, many parents really do want to know and understand the experience that their teen is having. So in the supervision tool, parents will be able to get insights into who their teen is chatting to, but they will not be able to see the messages themselves. We think that's really important. We want to strike the balance between helping the parent know and understand and be able to have a conversation with their young person about, what they're doing and who they're talking to on Instagram direct messages, but without breaking the privacy of that young person so the parent can't actually see the messages. So the parent will have the insight to be able to see over the last 7 days the account names of those that their teenager has been chatting to on direct messaging, but not the messages themselves. We've also set total daily time limits for their teens. So they have a 1 hour time limit for daily use on Instagram that the parent can change together with the young person. And we're also introducing what's called sleep mode. So between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., sleep mode will turn on Instagram, again, automatically defaulted on. And that means that during that time, the young person will not be able to have any notifications at night. The parent will also have the ability to block Instagram during those hours as well, which I think is a really important feature in order to address some parental concerns around nighttime use of social media. And then we'll also be able to see some of the topics that their teen is looking at, but not the content itself as well. And then the question is kind of how do we know a teen is a teen? I think this is really important, and we are absolutely thinking about this fundamentally on Instagram. So you have to be 13 to have an Instagram account to begin with. We already have ways to age assure and to know the difference between someone who's under or over the age of 18. We know with teen accounts that some young people may try to change their settings to change their age so that they are seen as an over 18 on Instagram. Absolutely are anticipating this. And so if a teenager does try to change their age, say from 15 to 19 or 20 over the course of the next few weeks and months, as we're rolling out this globally over the course of the next few months, that young person will be asked to age assure. And we're giving them lots of different ways they can do that really, really easily. They can send us a piece of ID, but also they can do it through what we already have on the platform, which is a Yoti led age assurance system. So they can just take a photograph and make sure that they are over the age of 18. So we're also on top of that building technology in the future to find accounts that belong to teens who may have lied about their age, and then we'll be automatically placing them into this protected age-appropriate setting. This technology will allow us to proactively find accounts belonging to teens, even if the account lists an adult birthday. And we'll be starting testing this in the US in January, and then we'll be rolling it out globally at a later date. As I said, for Ireland and the rest of the EU, we plan to start putting teens into the new teen account experience before the end of this year. So it is a really exciting and it's a really fundamental change to that experience on Instagram for millions of teens. We need to make sure that everything works correctly, that we are taking the time that we need to ensure it launches and it launches well and it launches smoothly.
Can we delve a little bit deeper into the parental supervision side of things for the under 16s? So if a parent is not currently on Instagram, do they need to now join the platform, set up an account, and engage to be able to control or view those various aspects that you've just outlined?
They do. So the way the teen accounts will work is that anyone who is new to Instagram over the next few weeks and months, as well as existing users of Instagram, if you are under the age of 18, you will be placed into a teen account experience. You'll be sent, if you're a teen, you'll be sent a notice to let you know what it is. Very, very clear, easy to use language to explain to the teenager that they're going to be put into this more protective experience. The more protective experience involves things like defaulted private account, defaulted into time settings on Instagram, and defaulted into what we call the sensitive content controls. You're seeing less sensitive content on Instagram. If the teenager wishes to change any of those default settings into a less restrictive setting, then if they're under the age of 16, they have to get the approval from their parent. So when they're asked if they try to change, say they've got a public account, they've got a private account, they try to change into a public account, we'll send them a notification if you're under the age of 16 to say you have to get parental approval in order to change that setting. And if they don't have supervision set up, we'll be prompting them to set up supervision. And then the parent will get an email to tell them that their young person is asking them to set up a supervisory account on Instagram. And then they'll join Instagram and they'll be given a really, really clear and easy path to be able to set up the supervision tool. So they and their young person then are in a supervisory relationship. And then if they approve, if they're okay with their young person having a public account, then they can set that up on supervision.
Mm. This is a brave thing for Instagram to do. You know, you and I have spoken before. I've spoken to other executives. I've spoken to other platforms about the need to keep younger people safe online. And this is a big stride towards that. Are you anticipating any sort of fallout or backlash from younger people on the platform as a result of these changes? Or is there, you know, research or data that shows there is a willingness and a want from all parties, including younger people, for a safer platform?
Yes, through the research and all of the conversations we've had with teens over many years, with their parents over many years, and with youth and safety experts and advisors, we do think that teen accounts is striking the right balance. That adding the protective experience for those young people, making a difference, a differentiating between the younger teen and the older teen, we think is really important. We're hearing that from parents. We're hearing that from the stakeholders that we work with. The Irish the Data Protection Authority has suggested similar in the fundamentals for young people as well. There is a difference in maturity and age levels and the way young people are experiencing social media if you're under or over the age of 16. So we've built in those extra protections for those younger teens. As I said, for older teens, they have that little bit more autonomy. We do think this is a really strong, valuable proposition for young people. They tell us they also don't want to be contacted by people that they don't know. But we're also trying to strike that balance by bringing the parent into the conversation and really responding to those parental concerns, which they told us about, which are, They want to know the kind of content their young person is seeing on Instagram. They want to be able to help their young people spend the right amount of time using Instagram. And we think our time management tools really do help them to do that. And they want to know who they're connecting with and the conversations that they might be having on Instagram. And we really want this to be holistic. It's not just the supervisory tool is really there, yes, to add a bit of extra protection for that young person. But we really hope it instigates conversations at home as well. We want the parent to be sitting at the kitchen table or on the sofa or in the car having a conversation with their young person about the time that they're spending on Instagram and who they're talking to, what value they're getting out of it, what fun they're getting out of it. But we want that to be a whole family experience. We really hope that teen accounts will bring the parent into the conversation as well as being valued by the young person who's using Instagram.
Yeah, and I suppose this is something that I talk about quite a lot. You know, it is obviously very important to have safeguards, but it's also important to highlight that there are good experiences and, you know, good connections that come from a digital life. So having those three core principles in place that, as you've outlined, will hopefully have a positive impact in terms of safety. But beyond that, am I right in saying that, you know, the day-to-day experiences of younger people on the platform should not change dramatically?
No, absolutely not. They really should be having the same experience that they currently are having on Instagram. It's about providing those safeguards, as you said, and it's about providing that sense of protection and security, particularly to the parent. Fundamentally, with teen accounts, we will be setting all of these protections in place by default. The young person doesn't have to change those. The young person can just keep on having a private account by default. We will be defaulting them into these nighttime mode and into having a daily 60-minute time limit on Instagram. They don't have to change any of those if they don't want to. If they do want to change them, they bring the parent into the conversation. They set up the supervisory experience on Instagram. But actually, what we anticipate is a lot of young people will just, they really value these type of protective experiences. We know that young people, teenagers, really do value feeling safe online, and they want to experience Instagram, other social media, and just have fun with it and not be worried about anything else around the edges. So we really do hope that teens will value it. We think they will. It is, as you say, a fundamental shift, but we think it's absolutely striking the right balance between allowing and giving that young person the autonomy and the fun and the experience on Instagram, while also giving the parents that extra peace of mind.
Great stuff. Well, look, it is a significant shift, I think, towards safer online experiences for younger people, and I'm very eager and excited to see it coming to Ireland, which, as you said, there will hopefully be in the next wee while. But for the moment, Tara Hopkins, Global Director of Public Policy at Instagram, thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks for your time.
Yeah, so there it is. Teen accounts will be coming to Ireland in the near future. It is being rolled out in certain parts of the world already. If you're a parent, I would love to hear from you. What do you make of this solution? Would you feel better having eyes on the different solutions that Tara outlined? Are you confident engaging and manoeuvring your way through the Instagram platform? You can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. Right, when we come back here on News Talk, we're going to take a closer look at what tech has done to company culture. Stay tuned.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Yeah, you are listening to Tech Talk here on News Talk. This is Jess Kelly. Before the break, we were talking about Instagram's teen accounts, which are coming to Ireland later this year. They've started to roll out in different parts of the world. But if you want to initiate some of the online safety conversations with your children right now, so ahead of the arrival of the teen accounts in Ireland, there are some brilliant resources out there for parents. One that I want to mention in particular is on the ispcc.ie website. So the ISPCC does incredible work and has done for many years now. But one area in which they are, I suppose, going the extra mile for both parents and children is around digital education. So if you go to ispcc.ie, at the top of the website, you'll see a portion or a tab called Digital Hub. And this is a space for both children and parents. So you can go in and you can read different news updates. You can tap into videos where you have a series of online experts explaining different aspects of the online world. They give you prompts for conversations with your children. There are different guides and tips when it comes to building digital resilience, empathy online, what are the big risks when it comes to the digital world, but also what to do if something goes wrong. I do think, you know, as I said in the chat with Tara Hopkins there a minute ago, there are great benefits from what they're doing now. It's a huge stride in terms of introducing these online teen accounts, but teenagers aren't just on Instagram. They're on other platforms, and I think it's important for parents to know where they can turn if and when something does arise. So again, it's the ispcc.ie website. Just search for it, click on Digital Hub, and there is plenty of stuff there that is worth your time. And as I said, it's worth getting ahead of before an issue arises. Right, something that caught my eye, talking of Instagram, this week was a conversation around the company culture at Netflix. They have something called the Keeper Test, which we're going to talk about in just a quick minute. But it got me thinking about, and I suppose chatting to some people about, how tech companies set the bar for company culture. So there was a time a few years ago where I'd walk into a tech office and they'd have a ping pong table and a beer keg and all the rest. That seems to have gone away. Attitudes from the company's point of view and the workers' point of view have shifted. So what actually matters when it comes to company culture, and should that dictate where you work? I'm joined now by Paul McArdle of The Panel and a contributor to The Currency. Paul, I've read some of the pieces you've written recently about different books about company culture, obviously there's the one that we're going to come to in a quick minute about Netflix in particular. But before we get into that, I just wonder, have lessons been learned about worker well-being and company culture post-pandemic? Because a lot of the tech companies, you know, when the pandemic hit, they were saying this is the new normal. Remote working is the new normal. We won't force employees back to the office. We'll let them do that whole thing of work anywhere. But now it's a case of not only do we want you back, but you have to come back.
So first of all, thanks for having me on, Jess. Secondly, the big tech companies originally, when COVID drove this, they got access to much greater talent pools who are working remotely. So they were finding talent all around the globe who they didn't have to be in office. There was a bit of a gold rush with COVID, and then we've seen with some of the tech companies that that COVID gold rush is gone, and then they've resized their businesses. How some of them handle that is a lesson and not how to do it, because they're doing it by small cuts rather than doing one big cut at a time. And culturally, that had a very adverse effect on the people who are going, who felt their loyalty wasn't rewarded, and on the people who were staying because they didn't know where they're going to be next or not. The push into the office in a lot of the tech companies tends to be US-led. I think partially because a lot of those businesses have investments in office themselves. So they are looking to drive people into buildings that they are paying for. They believe that culturally people work better together on site than they do remotely. But when it suited them, when people were working remotely, they thought the culture was fine. So on the situations as I see it, that we're kind of at a tipping point, the power is going back towards the employer. We did a candidate sentiment survey with 2,000 people later the panel, which we published in The Currency. And for the first time, they feel the power is back with the employer. But it's very well balanced. And what's going to be interesting, Jess, is to see how this plays out in the next 6, 12, 18 months.
How and where does this sit within the culture of big tech companies as they exist right now? Like I mentioned the piece that you wrote recently for The Currency about Netflix as an example. When we look at how they operate, are there lessons to be learned for the tech sector as a whole from what they do and their approach?
So Netflix have no rules. They're very specific culture where they have what's called F&R, freedom and responsibility. So they have a culture of empowerment for their teams. So what that means is that a person, if they think it's right for Netflix, can go and, for example, buy a very large TV program, commit to that without going through a hierarchical structure and waiting for everybody to say yes to it. The other thing about it is they believe in talent density. In a nutshell, what happened was they let people go who were underperforming, and they found that productivity went up with less people. So they have a thing called the Keeper Test. So the Keeper Test has developed within Netflix. It started with the question is, if one of your team hands in their notice, how hard would you work to keep them? And that became known as the Keeper Test. And then they had a second iteration of that, Jess, and where instead of waiting someone to hand in their notice when they're reviewing their team, they'd actually, the question was, if that person did hand in their notice, how hard would I fight to keep them? And keep talent density up. If the answer to that was, I wouldn't fight to keep them, they would sit down with that person and cut a check and let them go. Mm-hmm. So they have gone from a lot of companies would have culture just around being family. Netflix would have a culture very similar to that of a professional sports team. And So you need to be a high level performer and you need to be consistent. And if you're not consistent or your performance dips, then there are other places that you should work rather than that bit.
That notion of we're all one family here, like that used to be the norm in work. It was seen as a very enticing prospect for employees. But another lesson that was learned during the pandemic was around employee expectations, their needs, their wants, and so on. We know that they want to do meaningful work and be fulfilled. Is it too much to say that perhaps the approach by Netflix and their keeper test could be actually mutually beneficial? Because if you're not performing well, maybe it's because you're not fully bought in?
Definitely is for high performers. It definitely is, and you're spot on. I think that people are very keen to have a material positive effect in their workplace by the nature of the work that they do. So they want to be working on projects that are meaningful. They want to be more productive and they want to be involved in decision making. That's one thing that the Netflix team have done with the freedom to go make the decisions you think are right for Netflix, but the responsibility to come with that, the F&R, that yin and yang, that balance to get it right. On the family piece, there are still companies who do that, and I think it's still as valid today as ever was. In fact, in the panel, we have our values are plan, so which is the Irish word for family. So we would see ourselves culturally aligned with that. Where Netflix, they were saying if it's a professional sports team, having a family culture is not relevant to that because you're not going to put your brother or sister, in inverted commas, out of the team. So I think different cultures work well within different businesses. Netflix has proven to work well for them, but it's been well honed by Netflix over a number of years.
The other thing that we know is that culture and cultural differences is something that really impacts tech companies. Anytime I'm out at the likes of Microsoft or Meta or whatever big tech company, you see diverse teams, which is obviously great. But I wonder if that, you know, we're a sports team versus we're a family approach is actually a better one when it comes to, I suppose, leveling the playing field for office and company culture at large.
I would say that, so Erin Maher is the professor in INSEAD, so she co-wrote the Netflix book on their culture, and she also wrote the culture map. On the culture map, what I think one of the most important books I've read this year, it deals with how you deal with people from different cultures and how they deal with you. I think that is more related to our cultural background as opposed to whether we're in a Netflix or in a family-led culture. So, for example, he gives in the book that if you say something to an Irish person, we take things literally and we know what is meant. If you say something to a Japanese colleague, for example, they look for nuances and they might interpret it in a very different way, so they don't take it literally. So whether you're working in a Netflix or whether you're working in a family culture environment, that is really important to know. So I think that it's more to do, as I said, with our own different cultural nuances rather than the type of company culture that we work in is the most important thing to pay attention to.
What does all this mean for the future of work? Like, we've been talking about work anywhere culture for quite a while. It, you know, was seen to be a great way to let people live the lives they want to live whilst also working hard when they were in, you know, work mode. Are we shifting back to office-based workplaces with the Netflix-like keeper test for each business to find and flesh out their own ethos?
So I think that Netflix culture is something that they've built over a long time and is going to suit some businesses and not suit a lot of others. There is still a talent shortage on the market. When I spoke earlier about it being more an employer market than an employee market, yes, that is going to be a factor in getting more people back into the office. However, I do not think it's going to be straightforward. The other thing I would say is I think that remote work and hybrid work is here to stay, and it works very, very well in a lot of situations, and it doesn't in others. I don't see a huge change in that, because I think it's going to be driven to where the talent actually is. And so, for example, if you're a business and you need a software developer and that person happens to be in Eastern Europe and can do the job very sufficiently there, rather than have them come in here where there's a housing crisis and shortage and you have to pay them probably more to be in situ in the office, then that solution, like their solution, is always going to win out, in my opinion. So I do think things are going to change. I think you're going to see more people coming into the office, but maybe not to the level that the, which is mainly US-led companies, would like to do.
If you're a small or medium business here in Ireland and you're looking at, you know, how to get the most out of your team, is the conversation that we've had up to now, is this something that only applies to multinationals, or are there takeaways here for the SMBs?
So, yes, the great thing about smaller companies is they're much more flexible. So we talked about purpose. Smaller businesses are nimble. You get a lot of wider experience in them than you would in a large multinational, where people tend to be in more siloed roles. You've got more flexibility in working arrangements. A lot of SMEs I know, because there's a smaller number of people, they don't have to be as rigid in their processes and in their controls. With the Netflix example or with the family example, a lot of the SMEs pick what the best culture is for them and develop their own culture in time. So there's no reason why they can't have people performing at a very high level, but have, say, a more family-friendly approach to how those people work. And that's where I think that SMEs have quite a competitive advantage at the moment, because they've much more control in setting their own culture. Due to the scale of the business, they can influence that culture much better than, say, a large company can.
I've been thinking about this for quite a while, and when I read your piece in The Currency about Netflix, it really got me thinking about younger generations entering the workforce. From, you know, research that I've done, from what I've read, what I've seen, what I've heard, be that in my life or on social media, the younger generation definitely has a different attitude to work. There was talk, you know, on TikTok not that long ago about Gen Z quiet quitting and not doing anything beyond their job description. And as a millennial, that jumped out at me, because that's just not the way I started my career, and it's not how I work to this day. How do the different generations in a workplace that is shifting, or that has a more hardline approach, excel and get ahead?
So, yes, it's interesting. We've had taken on people who are in their early 20s, and we find them just like you were, very willing to learn. I haven't seen that thing work, kind of work the rule, that TikTok generation piece that you're talking about. The big issue culturally for younger people is they're not learning things by osmosis if they're working remotely or if they're working in a mainly hybrid fashion. The huge plus of working in an office and working beside people more senior from you, you learn far more from listening to them or seeing how they operate. And that has been missing. Quite interestingly, Jess, the issue with going into the office, not the younger people, it's the partners, MDs, in a number of the professional services firms, both in law firms and in accountancy firms, they've had to have a policy to get the partners in as opposed to the young people in. I find any of the young people that I've met, and I myself learned from the ground up, and I think you did as well when you went into New Talk. I think you were a runner off memory and learned your way around. I found young people coming into our business, and we've had a number of interns and a number of people who've taken on permanently, have had a superb attitude to learn that. I don't recognize that TikTok generation at all. But I do simply for people of the younger generation is they're not getting the opportunity to learn by osmosis the way that you and I did back in the day.
Yeah, and that is something that really resonates with me. Like when I started making tea and coffee here in Newstalk, I was watching and learning how to behave, but also how not to behave by osmosis. How important is it for potential employees to do their homework on a company's culture before they go for a job and find out if they are, a keep-or-test kind of company or a family-like business? Because that really does set the tone for the entire work life.
It absolutely does. But I think the most people nowadays are very savvy. A lot of them are on social media, and it's very easy to find out about companies either from whatever they have communicated externally from their employer branding or from hearing from people working in that place and from friends and colleagues who might have worked there in the past. What I would say for somebody looking for work is that a lot of employers are taking the aptitude for granted. It's the attitude of the person that is key, and that's proved to be a key differentiator. The second thing I would say, Jess, is in the past, and I've recruited myself, they always had prerequisite that somebody had to have a degree. That's gone now. Thankfully, we're going towards a more skills-based hiring. So they are looking at skills that the individual has and seeing how they can apply to a particular role. In the past, you would have, say, I'm looking for a degree, and it was just to filter out people rather than put them in. So I think that as talents have got more difficult to get, and one of the good things that's happened is that employers are more open to the background of people that they take on. Another branch of people that have done well out of this, well, two really, people with disabilities. So remote working has opened up roles for them that wouldn't have had in the past. And I think there's a rise in the grey market. People 50, I think employers are seeing that there is value in taking those people on where ageism was fairly rife beforehand. So I think there's positive things out there in the job market. Employers that are looking at wider talent pools and more opportunities for people who may have been restricted in the past.
Okay, there is no doubt that we are in an interesting time, and I imagine this is something that we will come back to time and again. But for now, Paul McArdle, thanks so much for joining me here on News Talk.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a great day.
I would love to know what you make of the keeper test. Is that fair enough? Maybe you work on a team that you think could benefit from it. Let me know. You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Right, when we come back, I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes' time, John Fardy is going to be here with Screen Time. John, what's on the show this week?
Thanks, Jess. Well, this week on the show, I'm talking to WandaVision herself, Elizabeth Olsen, about her new movie, His Three Daughters, a powerful movie about three daughters looking after an ill father, and Rolling Stone called it the movie of the year. And talking of WandaVision, the showrunner on that has created a new show on Disney called Agatha All Along, and I'm talking to her about kind of defying expectations when it comes to superhero and witches and fantasy stuff. And then continuing on the success of last week's interviews on Emily in Paris, I'm bringing you actress Mandy Chan, who plays Lily Collins as Emily's best friend in Emily in Paris, which of course is streaming on Netflix at the moment. And Jess, I'm going to have to tell you my interview with Lily Collins last week, at the last time of checking, has 1.3 million views on TikTok. There you go. I thought you'd like that as a, social media guru. Thank you, Jess.
Oh, well, very impressive. If you want to have a look at some of John's interviews or anything from us here at News Talk, make sure you're following us at News Talk FM on Instagram, TikTok, and sure, wherever else as well. Right, before we go,
I mentioned at the start of the show, I've spent the week in my sick bed because my life is just too glamorous. But do you know what I started to rewatch? That is, of course, the iconic theme tune from The West Wing. I have delved back into it. It is on the Channel 4 player. If you've never watched it, get on it. If you've watched it, but not for quite a while, get back on it. It just makes my heart so happy. And it is amazing to see all of the cast doing bits and pieces back together again. They appeared at the Emmys last week to encourage people to go out and vote. They were at the White House on Friday. So yeah, it is just fantastic. Get on it if you're not already. Elsewhere, I also watched the Sopranos documentary, which is on Sky. This is a sit-down chat, essentially, with David Chase, who's the creator of the show. And if you are a Sopranos super fan like I am, it is definitely worth your time. Now, I did find bits of it quite self-indulgent. It's portraying the tortured genius that is David Chase. But you also get to see my favourite bit, which was the cast members or other actors who auditioned to be, whether that is Tony, Syl, Adriana, the mother. It's just fascinating. So again, if you are a Sopranos super fan, it is definitely worth jumping on. In terms of books, what I've read this week was Freda McFadden, who's an author I've mentioned a few times on the show. I binge read quite a few of her books a little while ago. They're completely free on Kindle Unlimited. So if you are a subscriber to Kindle Unlimited, they're all there for you. But her big series is The Housemaid, and there's quite a few in the series. The latest one is The Housemaid is Watching. Again, free on Kindle Unlimited, read it in a day and a half, absolutely loved it. So that is definitely a series worth delving into. If you like twisty, crime, thrillery, but not too scary type books, which I'm sure is a genre you will find in your local bookstore. Another book I want to give a shout out to, actually, what I think of it, is The Last Disco, which comprehensively tells the story of the Stardust tragedy. I obviously work in a newsroom, right? So I've been familiar with the story of what happened at the Stardust. But this book, which is written by three journalists who covered the case thoroughly, gives an incredible account of the people who were there in attendance, as well as the impact that it had on their families and indeed the survivors of the Stardust tragedy as well. It is absolutely fascinating, and I do think it makes for such a compelling read, and it's an important read as well. So again, it is called The Last Disco. As ever, if you have recommendations for me, whether it's TV shows, books, podcasts, whatever, let me know. Email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, another big event that took place this week was, of course, the National Ploughing Championships. They had stunning weather for the few days, which is great to see. Newstalk's Henry McKean was down there and he visited the Engineering Ireland tent, where he spoke to Damien Owens about some of the innovations that were on display.
Well, engineers solve problems, and engineers will be solving the problems of climate change, which affects us all, and we need the strength of the farming community behind us to achieve this. And technology plays a vital part in, say, for example, monitoring animal health real time for either animal health or the yields on crops. That's all done real time and delivered to the farmer via the internet, via technology. We also see, for example, the development of tractors that can go out on their own, dealing with GPS, and be very efficient in going into the corners field and make sure that areas of the field only get sprayed with seed or fertilizer once and not twice or three times, which is wasteful and potentially harmful to the environment.
And beside us, we have a robotic dog. What is this?
This robotic dog, we call him Satanta, and basically he's quite a clever piece of technology. So you can send him into areas where you may not want to send a human. He can take measurements, go into, say, a farm shed, and scan it and make measurements of all the pipes and give you a 3D image of what's there. So it's a very efficient and high-tech piece of equipment. Now, it won't replace sheepdogs.
Well, it could. It could be the next sheepdog. It can walk.
A very long time before
it can't. It can't bark.
No, I prefer sheepdogs. No, I think we'll not be making sheepdogs redundant anytime soon. But this is a fabulous piece of technology as an aid to the humans, not replacement.
Yeah, that was News Talk's Henry McKean speaking to Damien Owens of Engineers Ireland. It looked like a fantastic ploughing championships, a whole lot of tech on display. If you were there, I hope you enjoyed it. But it's great to see the innovation continuing, and I hope, fingers crossed, to be there next year. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.